Tonight what I want to do is share with you one of the suttas. This sutta illustrates the gradual training. I mentioned the gradual training the other night, saying that it's a description of all the practices that one undergoes on the spiritual path from first beginning all the way to full awakening. And it shows the jhanas in context. The gradual training includes the three parts of sila, samadhi, panya: ethical behavior, concentration, wisdom. So when we get into the gradual training in this sutta, you might pay attention and see if you can identify the three parts. The sutta is from the long discourses. It's the second discourse, the Samanyapala Sutta, the discourse on the fruits of the spiritual life. There's a fairly good translation of this sutta on the accesstoinsight.org website, if you're familiar with that website. If you're not familiar with that website, it's an excellent resource for Theravadin Buddhism. There are lots of suttas translated there for free, and many other materials as well. accesstoinsight.org. And so you can find this under the long discourses, number 2. Now I'm going to tell you my version of the sutta, what I've learned. Maybe you should read the real one when you go home, but I'll give you what I got. Thus have I heard. Once the Buddha was staying in Jivaka's mango grove with a company of 1,250 monks just outside the city of Rajagaha. Now at that time, on the night of the full moon, King Ajatasattu, king of Magadha, was sitting on the upper terrace of his palace, surrounded by his ministers and other members of the court. It was the full moon night, and when the moon rose, King Ajatasattu uttered a joyful exclamation. Oh, what a beautiful night! Oh, what a wondrous night! Oh, what an auspicious night! Perhaps we could visit some recluse or Brahmin who could bring some peace to my mind. You see, King Ajatasattu had a very unpeaceful mind. This was because he had killed his father, good King Bimbisara. King Bimbisara was one of the Buddha's very first patrons. King Bimbisara encountered Siddhartha Gautama before he became the Buddha. The story goes that King Bimbisara was in his palace on one of the upper stories, looking out the window, and he saw this recluse on alms round below. And he was not like the other recluses. He had a more kingly bearing. And so King Bimbisara called one of his ministers over and said, "Follow that recluse, see where he goes, and report back to me." So the minister followed Siddhartha Gautama to Vulture Peak, which is a mountain outside the city of Rajagaha. It's a very good place to meditate because it's got very many caves. And so the minister reported back to King Bimbisara, and King Bimbisara went to visit Siddhartha Gautama. He learned his story and was impressed enough that he offered a ministerial position to Siddhartha Gautama in the kingdom of Magadha. But Siddhartha Gautama wanted to find out what to do about all this dukkha, and so he politely declined. But King Bimbisara got him to promise that if he figured it out, he'd come back and tell him. And sure enough, about 3 years after his awakening, the Buddha returned to Rajagaha and gave a discourse to King Bimbisara, and King Bimbisara was established in the fruit of stream entry, the first level of awakening, and he became a devoted follower of the Buddha. But King Bimbisara had a son, Prince Ajatasattu, and Prince Ajatasattu was a very ambitious man. He grew tired of waiting for his father to die and decided to take matters into his own hands. He strapped a dagger to his thigh and went sneaking into the king's private quarters, where he was promptly apprehended by the guards. And they dragged him before the king and they said, "Great king, we caught your son sneaking into your private quarters and he had this dagger strapped to his thigh. Son, why were you sneaking into my private quarters with a dagger strapped to your thigh?" "I was going to kill you, Dad." "Well, why do you want to kill me?" "I want your kingdom." "Why didn't you just say so? Here, you can be king." And he made him king right on the spot. But King Ajatasattu grew worried that his father, who was now going off to meditate, would get bored with the meditation and want his kingdom back. So he ordered his father thrown in the dungeon. He didn't have the heart to order him killed. He just cut off all his food. He did allow one visitor, the queen. The queen was very sharp. When she would go to visit her husband, she would smear her body with honey, and the king could live by licking it off. When King Bimbisara wasn't dying, King Ajatasattu went to see him. "Dad, how come you're not dead yet?" "Oh, when your mother comes to visit, she smears her body with honey, and I can live by licking it off." End of visits from the queen. But still, King Bimbisara wasn't dying. So King Ajatasattu had him tortured. And during the torturing, he died. It is said in the commentaries that two messages arrived at the palace at the same time. The first message to the king was that a son had been born. And for the first time, King Ajatasattu understood a father's love for a son. And he said to his ministers, "Release my father from prison." And then they gave him the other message, which said that his father was dead. From that night on, King Ajatasattu had terrible nightmares. He would no sooner fall asleep than he would wake up screaming. And his servants would rush in, great king, are you all right?" I'm fine, go away, go away." And he'd fall asleep and have another nightmare. So he had developed insomnia. He couldn't sleep. And so on this full moon night, well, if the king can't sleep, nobody gets to sleep. And so he's sitting on the upper terrace of his palace, trying to avoid falling asleep, because he'll have nightmares. And all the ministers and other members of the court are sitting there, including Jivaka, who had given the mango grove to the Buddha. Jivaka was the royal physician. When the moon arose and the king uttered his joyful exclamation about wanting to see some recluse or Brahmin who could bring some peace to his mind, one of his ministers spoke up and said, "Great king, there's Purunakasapa. He's long gone forth. He's esteemed as holy. He's been a recluse for many years. He has many followers. You should visit him. Perhaps he can bring some peace to your mind." The king said nothing. Another minister piped up, "There's Makali Gosala. He's long gone forth. He has many followers." Each of the ministers called out the name of his recluse or Brahmin, praised them, but the king said nothing. When the commotion finally died down, the king turned to Jivaka, who was sitting nearby, and said, "Jivaka, do you know any recluse or Brahmin we could visit?" Jivaka said, "Great king, the Buddha, the perfectly awakened one, is living in my mango grove with a company of 1,250 monks. He teaches the Dhamma, which is good in the beginning, good in the middle, good in the end. You should visit him. Perhaps he can bring some peace to your mind." "Prepare the elephant vehicles, Jivaka." So Jivaka went running down from the upper terrace of the palace to the stables below, and he had 500 female elephants saddled up, along with the king's royal male elephant, And then he went running back up to the upper terrace of the palace and said, "The elephant vehicles are prepared. Great king, do as you see fit." So King Ajatasattu had 500 women of the court seated one each on the 500 female elephants. And he and Jivaka mounted up on the royal bull elephant. And they rode forth in full royal splendor with torchbearers going before. Must have been quite a sight on that full moon night. They rode out of the palace and through the new city of Rajagaha and into the old city and through it and out through the walls and turned left and headed towards the mango grove. When they got near the mango grove, King Ajatasattu began to worry. You see, it was quiet. It was a little too quiet. "Jivaka, are you betraying me? Are you turning me over to my enemies?" "No, great king. Why would you think that? You said there was 1,250 people in this mango grove. I don't hear a sound." "They're probably all meditating, great king. Look, you can see lights in the pavilion hall. Go forward, great king. Go forward." So they went as far as they can go on the elephants, and then they dismounted, the king and Jivaka and the 500 women of the court, and they went up to the pavilion hall. And King Ajatasattu looked around and he said, "Now, which one's the Buddha?" "He's the one sitting at the back facing everybody else." And so King Ajatasattu wandered around checking things out. He was eventually standing near the Buddha and he said, "Oh, if only my son the prince could enjoy peace such as the company of monks." The Buddha heard him and he said, "Great king, do your thoughts follow your affection?" "Yes, venerable sir, I love my son the prince very much and it would be wonderful if he could experience such peace as the company of monks experiences." And then King Ajatasattu saluted the Buddha, saluted the company of monks, and sat down at one side. And he said to the Buddha, "Venerable sir, may I ask you a question?"
"Certainly, great king, ask whatever you wish."
"Venerable sir, in my kingdom there are people who practice many different crafts. There are elephant trainers, horse trainers, there are archers, spearmen, commandos, chainmail warriors, camp marshals, standard bearers, swordsmen. There are garland makers, bakers, farmers. There are artisans of all sorts, accountants, statisticians, street sweepers, barbers. Every one of these people practices their craft, and it's possible to see some fruit of their labor visible here and now. Venerable sir, can you point out any fruit of the spiritual life that is visible here and now?"
"Great king, have you asked this question of any other recluses or Brahmins?"
"Well, actually, venerable sir, I have. I've asked a half a dozen different recluses and Brahmins about this matter, but they just preached their doctrine at me. They never got around to actually answering the question. It was most unsatisfying. It was like asking for a mango and being given a breadfruit. I never said anything. I just went away quietly. But I ask you again, venerable sir, can you point out any fruit of the spiritual life visible here and now?"
"Great king, I will ask you a question. Answer as you see fit. Suppose in your kingdom there's a slave, a workman in your palace, who rises before you, sees that your needs are met all day long, waits on you hand and foot, doesn't go to bed till after you go to bed. Suppose this slave, this workman, were to think, 'It is wonderful, it is marvelous, the result of meritorious deeds. For this king Ajatasattu is a man, and I am a man, and yet he enjoys the five strands of sense pleasures as though he were a god, while I wait on him hand and foot from morning to night. Perhaps I too should do meritorious deeds. Great King, at some point after this, suppose that slave were to shave off his hair and beard, put on the ochre robes, and go forth to the homeless life, leading a life restrained and practicing meditation. Upon hearing of this, would you send your soldiers saying, make that man come back and be a slave in my palace? Oh no, venerable sir. We would rise up before him. We would prepare a seat. We would see to his food, clothing, shelter, and medicinal requirements. We would provide for him righteous protection. Great King, is this not a fruit of the spiritual life visible here and now? Yes. Yes, venerable sir, it is. Venerable sir, can you point out any other fruit of the spiritual life visible here and now? Great King, I will ask you a question. Answer as you see fit. Suppose in your kingdom there is a farmer who toils in his fields from morning to night. And when it's harvest time, he winds up paying a large portion of his harvest as taxes to support the royal treasury. Suppose this farmer were to grow weary of paying taxes. Suppose he were to think, it is wonderful, it is marvelous, the result of meritorious deeds, for this King Ajatasattu is a man and I am a man, and yet he enjoys the five strands of sense pleasures as though he were a god, while I toil in my fields from morning to night, and then he takes a large portion of my harvest as taxes for his treasury. Perhaps I too should do meritorious deeds. Great King, suppose at some point that farmer were to shave off his hair and beard, put on the ochre robes, and go forth to the homeless life, leading a life restrained and practicing meditation. Upon hearing of this, would you send your soldiers saying, make that man come back and be a farmer so he can support the royal treasury? Oh no, venerable sir, we would rise up before him. We would prepare a seat. We would see to his food, clothing, shelter, and medicinal requirements. We would provide for him righteous protection. Great King, is this not also a fruit of the spiritual life, visible here and now? Yes, venerable sir. Yes, it is. Venerable sir, can you point out any other fruit of the spiritual life, visible here and now, but more wondrous and more sublime than these? Listen, great King, and pay attention. A Tathagata arises in this world, a fully awakened Buddha who teaches the Dhamma, which is good in the beginning, good in the middle, good in the end. A householder or a householder's child hears the Dhamma and gains faith in the Tathagata. And at some point thinks, household life is crowded and dusty. Going forth is free like the air. And then this householder or householder's child shaves off hair and beard, puts on the ochre robes, and goes forth and joins the Tathagata's order. Great King, when one joins the Tathagata's order, one lives restrained by the precepts, the rules of behavior. We have many rules, Great King. The first of these is I undertake the training to refrain from killing living beings. The second one is I undertake the training to refrain from taking that which is not given. Many rules, Great King. We are celibate. We tell the truth. We don't engage in harsh speech. We don't engage in divisive speech. We don't engage in gossip or idle chatter. We don't take intoxicants. We only eat in one part of the day. We don't indulge in sleep in high and luxurious beds. We don't go to singing or dancing shows. We don't adorn ourselves with garlands or perfumes or jewelry. There are many rules, Great King. By keeping these rules, it makes it possible to live with the senses restrained. Upon seeing a sight with the eye,
One does not grasp at its signs or secondary characteristics, lest evil, unwholesome states such as covetousness or grief overcome one. When hearing a sound with the ear, smelling a smell with the nose, tasting a taste with the tongue, touching a texture with the body, or thinking a thought with the mind, one does not grasp at the signs or secondary characteristics, lest evil, unwholesome states, such as greed or covetousness or grief, overcome one. Living with senses restrained makes it possible to be mindful of all that we do, mindful when going forward and coming back, mindful when looking forward and looking back, mindful when carrying the robe and the alms bowl, mindful when going on alms round, mindful when eating, chewing, savoring, and swallowing, mindful when going to the toilet, mindful when standing, sitting, walking, or lying down. Mindful when falling asleep. Mindful when waking up. Mindful when speaking and keeping silent. We also live with very few wants or desires. All we need is food, clothing, shelter, and medicine if we're ill. With these few requisites, we can go anywhere we like. We're free to travel like a bird on the wing. With these noble precepts, this noble restraint of the senses, this noble mindfulness, and this noble contentment with little, it makes it possible to do the work of a recluse. Upon returning from alms round, having eaten the midday meal, one resorts to a secluded place, the root of a tree, the forest, a hillside cave, a heap of straw, a charnel ground, an empty room. One sits down cross-legged, holds one's body erect, and sets up mindfulness before oneself. Great King, when practicing meditation, there are five hindrances that can arise that hinder progress on the spiritual path. The first of these hindrances, Great King, is sense desire. Sense desire is like being in debt. If someone is in debt, they must continually work to pay back that debt. If someone is caught in sense desire, no sense desire is ultimately fulfilling, and one must continually work to obtain more sense desires. But if someone who is in debt manages to pay off that debt, they rejoice and become glad. In the same way, if one can overcome sense desire, even temporarily, one rejoices and becomes glad. The second of these hindrances is ill will and hatred. Ill will and hatred is like being physically ill. If you're physically ill, you don't feel well, you can't think straight, you are hot, and you can't do what you want to do. If you're overcome with hatred and ill will, you don't feel well, you can't think straight, you're hot, and you can't do what you want to do. But if a man were ill and were to take medicine and overcome that illness, he would rejoice and become glad. In the same way, if one can overcome ill will and hatred, even temporarily, one rejoices and becomes glad. A third of these hindrances, Great King, is sloth and torpor. Sloth and torpor is like being in prison. If someone is in prison, they just sit there, missing out on all the good things of life. If someone is overcome with sloth and torpor, it's really difficult to meditate. They just sit there, missing out on all the good things of the spiritual path. But if a prisoner were to gain his freedom, he would rejoice and become glad. In the same way, if one can overcome sloth and torpor, even temporarily, one rejoices and becomes glad. The fourth of these hindrances, Great King, is restlessness and remorse. Restlessness and remorse is like being a slave. A slave must go there and do that, come here and do this. A slave is always busy doing what the master wants, but not what the slave wants. It's the same with restlessness and remorse.
One's mind can't stay still. One's body can't stay still. One can't do what one wants to do, which is to meditate. But if a slave were to gain his freedom, he would rejoice and become glad. In the same way, if one can overcome restlessness and remorse, one rejoices and becomes glad. The fifth of these hindrances, great king, is skeptical doubt. Skeptical doubt is like being on a perilous desert journey where bandits abound and provisions are scarce. First one thinks to go this way, but no, there might be bandits. Then one thinks to go that way, but no, there won't be any water. One does more starting and stopping than actual progressing. It's the same with skeptical doubt. First one thinks to do this practice, but no, maybe that practice. No, it's not working. One does more starting and stopping and makes no progress at all. But if someone on a perilous desert journey were to reach a place of safety, they would rejoice and become glad. In the same way, if one can overcome skeptical doubt, even temporarily, one rejoices and becomes glad. Great King, when one sees that these five hindrances are not abandoned, one regards that as being in debt, as being physically ill, as being a prisoner, a slave, as a desert road. But when one sees that these five hindrances have been abandoned, one regards that as freedom from debt, as good health, as freedom from prison, freedom from slavery, as a place of safety. Thus, secluded from sense desires, secluded from unwholesome states of mind, one enters and remains in the first jhana, which is with thinking and more thinking, and is filled with rapture and happiness born of seclusion. One drenches deep, saturates and suffuses one's body with the rapture and happiness born of seclusion, so there is no part of one's body not filled with rapture and happiness. Great King, imagine a skilled bath attendant or his apprentice taking a metal basin and pouring in soap flakes and then pouring in just the right amount of water and mixing the soap flakes and water until the soap flakes and water become one homogeneous ball of soap. In the same way, one drenches deep, saturates, and suffuses one's body with the rapture and happiness born of seclusion, so there is no part of one's body not filled with rapture and happiness. Great King, this is a fruit of the spiritual life, visible here and now, and more wondrous and more sublime than the previous. Further, Great King, with the subsiding of thinking and more thinking, by gaining inner tranquility and unification of mind, one enters and remains in the second jhana, which is without thinking and more thinking, and contains rapture and happiness born of concentration. One drenches deep, saturates, and suffuses one's body with the rapture and happiness born of concentration, so there is no part of one's body not filled with rapture and happiness. Great King, imagine a lake far up in the mountains where there are no streams that come in from the east, the west, the north, or the south, and there are not even showers of rain. And yet, at the bottom of the lake, there's a spring of cool, clear water that totally fills the lake, that totally permeates the lake, so there is no part of that lake not filled with the cool, clear water. In the same way, one drenches deep, saturates, and suffuses one's body with the rapture and happiness born of concentration, so there is no part of one's body not filled with rapture and happiness. Great King, this too is a fruit of the spiritual life, visible here and now, and more wondrous and more sublime than the previous. Further, Great King, with a mind thus concentrated, with the fading away of rapture, and by remaining imperturbable, mindful, and clearly aware, one enters into the third jhana, of which the noble ones say, happy is one who is equanimous and mindful. One drenches deep, saturates, and suffuses one's body with a happiness free from rapture, so there is no part of one's body not filled with this happiness. Great king, imagine a lotus pond where there are blue, white, or red lotuses. They grow up out of the water, but do not come above the surface of the water. From their tips to their roots, they would be drenched, deep, saturated, and suffused with water, so there would be no part of those lotuses not suffused with the water. Great king, one drenches deep, saturates, and suffuses one's body with a happiness free from raptures, so there is no part of one's body not filled with this happiness. This too is a fruit of the spiritual life, visible here and now, and more wondrous and more sublime than the previous. Further, great king, with the passing away of pleasure and pain, as with the previous passing of joy and sorrow, one enters and remains in the fourth jhana, a state beyond pleasure and pain that contains mindfulness fully purified by equanimity. One sits suffusing one's body with a pure, bright mind, so there is no part of one's body not suffused with a pure, bright mind. Great king, imagine a man covered from the head down by a white cloth, so there is no part of his body not suffused by the white cloth. In the same way, one sits suffusing one's body with a pure, bright mind, so there is no part of one's body not suffused with a pure, bright mind. Great king, this too is a fruit of the spiritual life, visible here and now, and more wondrous and more sublime than the previous. Further, great king, with a mind thus concentrated, clear, sharp, bright, malleable, wieldy, and given to imperturbability, one can direct and incline it to knowing and seeing. One understands thus, this is my body, having material form, composed of the four great elements, born of mother and father, fed on rice and gruel, impermanent, subject to rubbing and pressing, to dissolution and dispersion. And this is my consciousness, which is bound up with it and supported by it. Great king, insights such as these into the nature of reality are also fruits of the spiritual life, visible here and now, and more wondrous and more sublime than the previous. Further, great king, with a mind thus concentrated, clear, sharp, bright, malleable, wieldy, and given to imperturbability, one can wield the various supernormal powers. One can construct a mind-made body. Being one, one can become many. Being many, one can become one. One can become invisible and reappear. One can walk through walls and ramparts as though they are not there. One can dive into the earth as though it's water. One can walk on water as though it is earth. One can fly cross-legged through the sky as though one were a bird. One can stroke the sun and the moon as mighty as they are. One can wield mastery as far as the Brahma realms. One can hear sounds at a great distance. One can know the minds of others. One can remember one's past lives. One can see beings passing away and re-arising according to their karma. Great king, supernormal powers such as these are also fruits of the spiritual life, visible here and now, and more wondrous and more sublime than the previous. Further, great king, with a mind thus concentrated, clear, sharp, bright, malleable, wieldy, and given to imperturbability, one can direct and incline it to the overcoming of the asavas, the intoxicants. One can understand, this is dukkha, this is the origin of dukkha, this is the cessation of dukkha, this is the path of practice that leads to the cessation of dukkha. One can understand, these are the intoxicants. This is the origin of the intoxicants. This is the cessation of the intoxicants. This is the path of practice that leads to the cessation of the intoxicants. And one can put an end to the intoxicant of sense pleasures. One can put an end to the intoxicant of becoming. One can put an end to the intoxicant of ignorance.
and in so doing, one puts an end to all dukkha. Great King, this too is a fruit of the spiritual life, visible here and now, and more wondrous and more sublime than the previous. And furthermore, Great King, there is no fruit of the spiritual life more wondrous and more sublime than this. The King was impressed. Wonderful, marvelous. It's like setting upright something that's been knocked down. It's like pointing out the way to one who is lost. It's like bringing a light into a room so that those who have eyes can see. I go for refuge to the Buddha and to the Dhamma and to the Bhikkhu Sangha. May the Buddha please consider me a lay follower from this day forth. And then King Ajitasattu got all shamefaced, and finally he blurted out, "Venerable sir, a transgression overcame me, in that for the sake of rulership, I killed my father, a righteous man and a righteous king." Great King, it's true, a transgression did overcome you in that you killed your father, a righteous man and a righteous king. But it is good that you acknowledge such a transgression for the sake of your restraint in the future. And then King Ajitasattu said, "We must be going. We have many things to do." "Do as you see fit, Great King." Then King Ajitasattu saluted the Buddha, saluted the company of monks, circumambulated the Buddha, and keeping the Buddha on his right, he headed back to where the elephants were parked, he and Jivaka and all the women of the court, and they mounted up and they rode back to the palace. Not long after they had left, the Buddha said to the monks, "This king has ruined himself. This king has destroyed himself. If he had not killed his father, a righteous man and a righteous king, then the stainless eye of Dhamma would have opened in him tonight, and he would have attained the fruit of stream entry. But this king has ruined himself. He has destroyed himself." And the monks were very pleased with all that the Buddha taught. Now, the sutta ends here, but the commentaries go on to say that King Ajitasattu went back to the palace and had his first good night's sleep since his father died. And King Ajitasattu did become a very strong protector of the Dhamma. 3 months after the Buddha's death, there was the first great council of arhats. 500 fully enlightened disciples of the Buddha came together just outside the city walls of Rajagaha. They obviously felt safe there in the protection of King Ajitasattu. But King Ajitasattu was an ambitious man, and after the Buddha's death, he set out on wars of conquest and conquered all of the neighboring kingdoms and built the nucleus of the first great Indian empire. But not all went well for King Ajitasattu. You see, his son killed him. And his grandson killed his son, and his great-grandson killed his grandson, and his great-great-grandson killed his great-grandson. At that point, the people of Magadha said, "Enough of these father killers." They killed the last of the line and established a new dynasty.